Hey, Adriana here. I wanted to let you know that starting this week, we'll be going back to our older format of one episode per week so that we can start easing into the summer and you can have more time catching up and going through our fabulous Birthful library. Happy listening. Postpartum body odor. It is a totally natural phenomenon because your body chemistry changes after giving birth. And so sometimes that means that what worked before is no longer effective. But I am excited to say that now there is a solution for that stubborn odor. The Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant is a completely natural deodorant made by a postpartum mom who went through it herself. And it works by eliminating and preventing bacterial body odor without covering up your skin's comforting smell to your baby while giving you 12 hours of odor control. And let me tell you, it actually works. Here at the house, we've all been trying it and loving it. Now, before you think, ew, you're sharing a deodorant with your husband and daughter, let me explain that this full body deodorant comes in a convenient pump applicator that lets you apply it anywhere on your body with no bacteria traveling on the deodorant, so no ew involved. We also love that the Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant has a delightful natural scent of USDA certified organic extracts that smell like a pink sugar cookie with lemon frosting. I thought this would be a little strange, but it's actually amazing. Also, the Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant is free from artificial fragrances and any kind of senoestrogens or herbs that can interfere with breastfeeding. Find your Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant at postpartumdeodorant.com. That's postpartumdeodorant.com and use the code BIRTHFUL for 20% off through the month of May. Get your Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant now at postpartumdeodorant.com and start smelling more like yourself again. Ugh, I love Jenny Kane. At this very moment, I'm feeling so comfy and cozy as I'm practically getting a hug from my Jenny Kane crop cashmere cocoon cardigan. I am enjoying this sweater so much that I've been living in it all spring long. And with Mother's Day just around the corner, this is a feeling you can gift all the well-deserving moms, moms-to-be, and mother figures in your life by giving them the gift of Jenny Kane. Along with bringing you this episode, Jenny Kane is a California brand through and through, and their staples make getting dressed so super easy. Think minimalist and effortless, but totally refined. Jenny Kane means luxurious cashmere sweaters, iconic accessories, elevated versions of your everyday basics, plus the most incredible home essentials. For a limited time, Birthful listeners get 15% off their first order. Go to jennykane.com and use the code BIRTHFUL15 to get 15% off and support the show. Jenny Kane is known for their quintessential sweaters, with their cotton collection providing you with the perfect everyday pieces as the days get warmer. But they also have gorgeous sundresses in a variety of silhouettes for any occasion and spectacular sandals to go along with them. Find the perfect Mother's Day gift or curate your new spring go-tos at jennykane.com. Birthful listeners get 15% off your first order when you use the code BIRTHFUL15 at checkout. That's 15% off your first order at jennykane.com, promo code BIRTHFUL15. Get yourself and the mothers in your life the gift of Jenny Kane. Welcome to the Birthful Podcast. I'm Adriana Lozada, and today's birth story is with Shay Cole. For Shay, getting pregnant was easy. The trick was staying pregnant. After three miscarriages, getting to the end of a pregnancy was such a mix of happiness and relief that brought along its own set of unusual circumstances like breaking her leg, having a stranger break into her house, and having her water break 78 hours before the birth of her daughter. Stay tuned. The Birthful Podcast, talking to maternity pros and new parents to inform your intuition. Hello, mighty parents and parents-to-be. Thank you, as always, for all the love you give the show and for sharing it with your friends and your family and people on the street and, you know, anybody who's pregnant. If what you hear is helpful, make sure to subscribe. It is free, and that way you won't miss a thing. Okay, so this month, October, is Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Month, and I find that this is, of course, a very tough but very important topic. Pregnancy and infant loss happen way more often than we know, and we don't talk about it that much. I looked up the numbers, and according to March of Dimes, about 15 to 25% of recognized pregnancies end in miscarriages, with about 80% of them happening in the first trimester. Now, if we take into account unknown early miscarriages or undetected pregnancies, then the rate is closer to 1 in 3, and I've even seen 1 in 2, 50%. So yeah, it is not uncommon to find out how many people around you have had a miscarriage once you yourself have had one or the topic comes up. If you've experienced a miscarriage or infant loss, I hope that you had really good support to lean on to get you through that very tough situation. And I also encourage you to talk about it if you feel ready, as these are alienating experiences that need to be acknowledged, and by sharing them, we can build more compassion around them. So today's story with Shay Cole does begin with the mention of her 3 miscarriages before she shares the story of her rainbow baby. I just wanted to make sure you knew that, and so here we go. Welcome, Shay. It is so good to have you here on the show today.
Thank you.
Yeah, I am very happy to hear that you've had your baby and connect, because so we talked on the phone over a year ago, more.
Yeah.
It's got to be closer to 2 years, right? Probably.
Yeah, I think so, because I think it was my first pregnancy when we were talking.
Yeah. And so a lot has happened in your life since then, and we will get to it. But before we do that, would you share a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. I am a first-time mom. I now have a baby that is almost 4 months old, and he is the joy of my life. My husband and I are so happy to have him, but it's taken us a while to get there. We, tried for a couple years to get here, and I learned a lot along the way. So I've been a faithful listener to your podcast. And I've known for quite some time that, I really want to share my story with your listeners. And so now I'm really happy to be here and to be sharing.
Yeah, and I'm happy you're here. When you reached out, you mentioned that you've learned so much along the way since you first decided, let's have a baby. So let's take you back to those, 2 years back or however long that was. And what were your feelings there? Who was that Shay that was approaching birth?
Yeah. I think that, I thought it was going to be super easy, right? Because I'm healthy, my husband's healthy. And I, haven't really ever faced a difficult time in a health scenario ever in my life. So when we decided we were going to have a baby, I thought I was going to, start trying and there would be a baby in my arms 9 months later. And it just didn't work out that way.
Mm-hmm. So would you mind sharing a little bit of what has happened in those during that first year, I guess?
Yeah, for sure. Well, what I will say is we never had a problem getting pregnant. I was using an ovulation tracking app and the timing method, and we got pregnant as soon as we tried. First try, we got pregnant. And of course, we were thrilled. But I had some spotting, and basically from the beginning. I told my doctor about it, and she said, can be normal. We'll keep an eye on it. But I did end up having, a miscarriage at about, I think it was about 11 weeks pregnant. That was a painful experience, both emotionally and physically. And after that, you know, I said to my doctor, what caused this? And she kind of said, well, you know, like often when you have a miscarriage, it's nothing that really caused it. It's just, you know, things didn't quite line up, you know, and it was, people don't really realize, a lot of people don't realize how common it is. I think it's like 20 or 25% of pregnancies end in miscarriage. Don't quote me on that, Adriana, you probably know better than me, but it's incredibly high. So she said, don't worry about it, try again, right? But I guess it's just the type of person I am. I felt like I needed to be proactive and that I would kind of go crazy if I didn't feel like I was doing something to increase my chances the next time. So I started working with a naturopathic doctor as well, just to make sure that nutritionally I was doing everything I could to make sure that it didn't happen again. Unfortunately it did happen again. And the second time it happened, right around the same time. And it was, kind of the same story, right? Where I was spotting all the way along. Now, I got pregnant right away as soon as we tried. So the time between those two miscarriages, it was not a very long period of time. So, you know, not a ton of time working with the naturopath before I got pregnant again. And then after the second one, we waited a little bit longer to try again. And I got pregnant for a third time. This time I had a miscarriage basically right away, like at like 6 weeks. But this time there was no spotting. It just it kind of just happened all of a sudden. And so then we started trying again and the fourth pregnancy was successful.
So between in that third one, that was a bit different. Was there any new questions being asked to your care providers, and were you getting any different insights from your intuition or mm-hmm. and or your doc, your naturopath and your OB and anybody else who was involved in this?
Yeah. So, you know, from the beginning, my naturopath said that she believed that, you know, based on, you know, her assessment of me and her assessment of how my miscarriages were going, she believed that I was not producing enough progesterone to support these pregnancies. And that's why the spotting from the very beginning. And so she was putting in place, the tactics that she had at her disposal to try to increase my progesterone, production. Now my medical doctor didn't really, so I live in Canada. I don't know if it's different in the US, but they don't really have much concern until after your third miscarriage. So they just tell you, like, don't worry about it. It can happen. Like, keep trying. After you've had three miscarriages, only then will they start sending you to a specialist and running more and more tests, right? But my naturopath was a little bit more proactive, right? After the first one, she said, okay, there's some things we can do to make sure that your hormones are on track. I'm not a medical practitioner, but the third miscarriage, it was so different, right? It happened right away and there was no spotting. So my instinct tells me that one was not because of progesterone. That one was the random, you know, chromosomes didn't line up and, you know, genetically it just didn't work out. Whereas the first two, it felt like my body couldn't support it. And after that third one, my naturopath said to me, you know, at this point in time, you know, you should probably try to be a little bit more assertive with your doctor, essentially. My naturopath gave me a tip. She said, they're going to be happy to run a blood test to check your progesterone levels, but they might not tell you that your progesterone changes throughout the month and you should go in on, I forget what day of the month it was. I think it was like the 21st day of my cycle or something like that, when the progesterone is at its highest or supposed to be at its highest. And get it checked then. So I went to my doctor, got the blood work requisition, went on the exact day my naturopath told me to go. And when the results came back, my doctor told me, oh, it's within the normal range. So I don't think progesterone is the issue. But I had her send my blood, the blood work results to my naturopathic doctor. And my naturopath took a look at it and she said, she's right. It's within the normal range, but it's at the very low end of the normal range on the day when you're supposed to have the highest progesterone.
Right. So that was indicating that was like barely getting in there.
Yeah, exactly. So then my naturopath said, look, there's all these things we can do that are gentle ways of urging your progesterone to be higher, you know, teas we can drink and tinctures and acupuncture. And we did all that. But she said, the thing that is really going to give you the most impact is a progesterone suppository. And she said, you know, a naturopath in Ontario where she practices is not actually, they're not licensed to prescribe that. So she said, you should ask your doctor about a progesterone suppository. I can't, you know, prescribe it to you, but you should ask your doctor about it. So I went and asked my doctor and my doctor said, actually, you know what, that can't hurt. So let's try it. So you go to a compounding pharmacy, they make you a progesterone suppository and you use it as soon as you get a positive pregnancy test for a few weeks. And I did that on my fourth pregnancy. And I really think that's what worked.
Oh, and great that you were absolutely proactive. And it just makes me think of how fertility is such a complex alignment of things. And we usually hear when we think fertility, people having issues of getting pregnant. And we don't hear so much about the staying pregnant. So I truly appreciate, your sharing that. Tell me though, how were you doing along all this? This must been like a year and a half. I don't know. How long was this experience to get from that first positive pregnancy test to your fourth one?
Well, my first positive pregnancy test was in October of 2017. And I finally had my rainbow baby in late June 2019. So, it was, but that being said, four pregnancies in that period of time is a lot. I didn't want to wait in between a miscarriage and trying again because I was so anxious to have my baby. And so I didn't want to give up, you know? That being said, it was very hard emotionally. And the fourth time I got pregnant, I remember like going for a walk with my best friend and saying to her, I don't know if I can handle another loss.
Yeah. So how were you during that first trimester waiting to get past, I guess, the 11th, 12th week?
Honestly, it's very nerve-wracking. I was like totally on edge. And you know, it should be a really happy time and you want to tell the world, but I didn't want to tell anyone until I knew for sure it was going to stick, because what I learned is the most painful thing is when you've told, like we did this the first time, we told all our friends, and a week later, we had to tell, you know, a week later, I had a miscarriage and friends would ask us, oh, how are you? How are you doing as a pregnancy? And then you have to say, oh, I lost it. And it's painful to talk about it, but it's also, I feel like it's painful for people to hear it too. So then you feel like you're inflicting pain on everyone you talk to, you know, so.
And that's such a tough situation because, as you said at the beginning, it is extremely common. Miscarriages, early losses are very, very common. The percentages, I think it's even like 1 in 3 that have had some experience of, and that's even known miscarriages because you might have an early loss that you don't even realize, you know, you didn't realize you were pregnant. And so the fact that this is so very common, but we don't talk about it means that so many people like yourself have to be going through this alone and kind of in this isolating situation of, I can't tell the people that I love because then I'm going to hurt them if something goes wrong, where it's like, who's supporting you when you're going through this? I mean, Yeah, it's like safeguarding others from the pain, but you are the one experiencing the most of the pain when it happens.
Yeah. And I will say, my naturopathic doctor was so good for that. I saw her fairly frequently because we were doing, you know, acupuncture and she, like, I feel like she was like a psychiatrist for me too, because she just, you know, she said, look, there are things we can do. You know, it's not hopeless. I have seen this happen before, and I've seen people have babies after, you know, 5, 6, 7 losses. And then they have a beautiful baby. So like, we'll get there, you know? And that was, it was really crucial to have that kind of support.
Mm. Did you get support from any other mental health specialist specifically, or was it more of the focus that, you know, we're just doing, she's telling me we can do it and we're just, let's not wait, let's keep going.
Yeah, no, I didn't talk to any mental health professionals. I mean, during this time, I saw my ND, I saw my family doctor, I did see a gynecologist who ran some tests. He basically said, look, I don't see anything wrong, like, keep going. I saw, you know, a midwife, because I thought, you know, the first pregnancy, I thought, okay, like, meet the midwife. I didn't know I was going to have a loss. So I feel like I was seeing lots of health professionals, but I didn't see a mental health professional. I'd say, you know, probably my husband was the biggest, kind of mental support for me, because he listened to me cry and, you know, be frustrated, but, you know, at the end of the day, said, like, it's okay. Like, we shouldn't put this time pressure on ourselves. Like, if it's going to happen, it'll happen eventually. And it's okay if it takes a while.
Mm. Well, I am, you know, sorry that you had to, of course, that you had to go through all that. And even if it's something that's very common, it's still, yeah, we should be able to talk about these things more. So thank you for sharing that so much.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, let's talk about this rainbow pregnancy. We'll be right back. And we are back talking with Shay Cole about her birth journey or her pregnancy journey. And so now you're pregnant for the fourth time. You have passed that critical 11, 12 week mark. Are you feeling like you can finally get into enjoying this pregnancy?
Yeah, I would say, like, I didn't start to feel a little bit better emotionally until maybe like week 14 or 15. That's when I was like, okay, maybe we're in the clear. I mean, the whole pregnancy, I was a little anxious, but at that point in time, I started to feel a little bit better. I mean, that's when you're like, for me, that's when my morning sickness also started to go away. So that probably helped a bit. But I think I started telling people that, like, week 15 or 16.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then in terms of preparation for what you wanted for birth, what were you doing relating to that?
Well, at this point in time, I started listening to your podcast in like the spring of 2017. So, like, you know, a good while before I even started trying to have a baby, I was thinking, okay, I'm going to do this kind of soon, right? So I started listening to your podcast. So at this point in time, by the time I came to my fourth pregnancy, I had listened to a lot of your podcast and checked out a lot of the resources that guests on your show mention, read some books, looked at the websites. So I felt really educated and really prepared. And it was great to have that confidence. But I would say that the piece of content that, you know, I actually got tipped off from your show, but it was Ina Mae Gaskin's book that really I found so, so useful. And that was, after reading that book, I was like, okay, I really want to have a natural, unmedicated birth, and that's my goal.
So then what did you do to set that into motion?
Well, I worked with a midwife at the birth center here locally. And the birth center was amazing. Honestly, it's, you know, compared to the when I compared the way I felt walking into that place versus the way I feel walking into a hospital, it was like night and day. You know, it's just such a beautiful, peaceful, like sunny environment. And I really could picture myself giving birth there. The midwives were amazing. They were so patient. They didn't, you know, they didn't make a huge deal of everything, right? It wasn't like every little thing was like overly measured and overly analyzed. And I think that was good for my anxiety, for my nerves, right? They were very like, oh, you know, like they educated me a lot, but they didn't, I just didn't feel like I was being overly poked and prodded, you know?
I do know.
So that was great. Like when I tell my girlfriends who had an OB that after the first visit, I never got weighed. And they, like, it's a little thing. And they're always like, what? They weighed me every time I went to the OB. And I'm like, nope, they weighed me the first time. That's it.
Yeah. I remember my pregnancy, one of the things that I didn't have to do that was like the thing, and I did it several times, but not every time I went in, which was to give a urine sample.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
Nope. Like there was more focus on talking and how I was feeling and how I was doing than, which takes more time. And of course there was like measuring of the belly and just, but if everything was going well and there was nothing to point you to be high risk, then they were just treating you like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And at the same time, of course, I was still educating myself. I was still, so my naturopath who had gotten me to this point, is also a doula. And so, I continued seeing her occasionally just to, you know, prep for the birth and also to make sure that I was on track with nutrition and my supplements and things like that. So that was really helpful. I sent you in my links as prep, Aviva Rahm's website. She has a really great section on natural pregnancy that I found super helpful in terms of like nutrition and you know, what supplements to take and things like that. And I did take a hypnobirthing class as well, which I think was, it was especially helpful in those few months leading up to birth to help me kind of like prepare myself mentally.
And I know this is anecdotal, but I'm wondering, because you were looking at Aviva Rahm's stuff and you were working with a naturopath, were you guys doing anything proactively to make sure you were groupie strep negative or trying to, you can't make sure, yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. So there, and I was groupie strep negative. There was, like a kind of a dietary, tips and tricks guide that my naturopath gave me. We made sure that I was on a really good probiotic. Aviva Rahm talks about this a lot about, also the benefits for the baby's microbiome and being on specific strains of probiotic for pregnant and breastfeeding women. And so there's a one that is specifically formulated for women and it, you know, helps you avoid UTIs and other stuff that's common during pregnancy. So we did that.
Do you remember which one that was? And again, we were telling people we're not giving medical advice and we're not. But.
Exactly. Yeah. It was the brand is Natural Factors and it's a women's probiotic with cranberry in it. So that's the one I started taking as soon as I started seeing my naturopath and I still take it. Yeah. And then the other thing, kind of related. There is a probiotic cream by Genestra. It's called HMF cream, and that is another example of like, you know, kind of getting advice from multiple practitioners and like seeing what works, whether or not that's good. But it worked for me because I had at one point I had asked my midwife, you know, if there was anything I could do for some issues I was having, and she sent me just to the pharmacy to get clotrimenazole. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
Like an antibiotic Lotion?
cream. Yeah, like Kinestin or whatever. And it didn't do anything. Kind of made things worse, actually. And my naturopath suggested this probiotic cream, this HMF cream by Genestra, and it worked like overnight. And it's actually, I found it's really good for diaper rash too.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'll look into that for sure.
Yeah.
So let's move you forward to day of or around. Yeah, I get excited. I'm like, how was the day of? And then remember that labor starts very many different ways. So how did it all start?
Well, so first of all, I guess I'll say that I was a week late and I was happy about that because I was in a cast because I had a broken foot.
Okay, wait, how did that happen?
So my due date was June 19th. And on the early in the morning on the last day of May, at about, this is a crazy story, at about 5 a.m., my dog started barking. And I, to kind of paint the picture, my husband's a helicopter pilot. So he was away flying. He had been away for a few weeks. I hadn't come home yet. And I live in the middle of the woods. Like most of my neighbors are like seasonal cottagers. We live on a lake, on a private road in the middle of the woods. So at 5 a.m. when my dog started barking like frantically, I was kind of freaked out, and I walked down my stairs, and there was a stranger sitting on my couch petting my dog.
Whoa.
Yeah, complete stranger. And so apparently what had happened was he was quite confused from drinking too much. And my door, like when I locked my door at night, it didn't fully click, my patio door. And this person had wandered into my house, not, you know, he was not aggressive. He just was confused. And he like took off his shoes at the door and sat on my couch petting my dog. So anyways, that was I ushered him outside and then called the police to come escort him home. But it was a traumatic experience. And when I was telling my friends about this, that day at work, they were like, oh my God, like you can't, we don't want you to stay at home alone tonight. Cause my husband wasn't home. So one of my friends came and stayed with me. And he brought his dog and like slept on my couch and was like, you know, I'm going to make sure that you're all right. It's very sweet of him. And then the next morning before he left, I was like, oh, let's, you know, it's beautiful. Let's take the dogs for a walk. And of course, I'm like, I can totally hike through the woods. No problem. I'm 9 months pregnant, but it's fine. Like I'm in good shape, whatever. Right towards the end of the walk, I was like stepping down from the woods on back onto the road, which is like a sloped kind of surface. And I like had to hop down a little bit. And, you know, when you're pregnant, you've got the relaxin running through your body. Your like joints are a little loosey goosey. I kind of like, I took a tumble, rolled my ankle, didn't land on my stomach because I caught myself by my arms, but couldn't walk. My friend had to bring me to the hospital. They did x-rays. They're like, yep, you have a broken, you know, the very bottom of your tibia there is broken. Had to get a cast. 9 months pregnant.
Whoa.
And be on crutches.
Like what was going on that weekend? What were the stars doing? I don't even know. That was crazy.
Yeah.
Very.
I know.
Oh, so, okay. You're 1 week late, happy because you've got your, what did your husband say when he got home?
He was just like, this is so typical, right? I'm a bit clumsy. So he's like, this is so typical. Like, it's kind of comical, right? I was fine. Like it was a pain in the butt because I was very active throughout my whole pregnancy. And then right towards the end, when I really wanted to, like, I had pictured myself kind of walking that baby out, you know what I mean? Like hiking the hills and in my neighborhood to like walk that baby out. But like, I couldn't because I couldn't really walk.
Requiring mental adjustment for sure. Let's take another break. We'll be right back. diaper rash. It can be a truly uncomfortable experience for a baby. And so I find that one of the biggest conundrums when diapering is figuring out what diaper cream to use. So many options are thick and goopy, making them hard to apply and hard to wipe off. But I can personally say that this is not the case for Dr. Mom Butt Balm. Dr. Mom Butt Balm is a pediatrician-approved skin protectant that is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, designed as a breathable formula to help maintain an optimal skin barrier while allowing the healing to occur. This butt balm was developed by a mom who is also a doctor, hence the name Dr. Mom Butt Balm, when she couldn't find any traditional products that worked for her baby's persistent diaper rash, and she wasn't about to settle. So she created Dr. Mom Butt Balm to go on smooth and be easy to remove while also being gentle on your baby's delicate skin. With Dr. Mom Butt Balm, you can say goodbye to excessive wiping to clean your little one's already chafed skin. Dr. Mom Butt Balm is so soft and goes on so smooth that you'll only need a small amount instead of having to layer on a thick goop. Plus, it has a lovely minty scent. Learn more about Dr. Mom Butt Balm at drmombuttbalm.com. That's drmombuttbalm.com. Or look for it at Amazon.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns, and sometimes I find that investing gets put off because it doesn't seem urgent or because with our busy lives, we may not have the time to research and manage said investments, which is why I so appreciate that Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future, and that you don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. So, for example, I take advantage of Acorns' roundup feature where they round up the purchase amounts I make in my linked account to the nearest dollar, and then they automatically transfer that to my invest account portfolio. Also, Acorns can recommend an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. For me, that's easy-peasy investing. Head to acorns.com/birthful or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Client testimonial may not be representative of all clients. Tier 1 compensation provided. Compensation provides an incentive to positively promote Acorns. View important disclosures at acorns.com/birthful. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Please consider your objectives, risk tolerance, and Acorns fees before investing. Acorns Advisors LLC Acorns is an SEC-registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are provided to clients of Acorns by Acorns Securities LLC. Member FINRA SIPC. For more information, visit acorns.com.
And we are back. I'm still like laughing from just picturing what I would do if I would come down and there was this guy just sitting on my couch petting my dog.
Yeah.
So then, okay, you're a week late. That cast happened right around your due date, right? So you've had this cast on for about a week?
No. So the cast, I was due on the 19th. The cast happened on June 1st. So, and it wasn't a super bad break. So I was still wearing the air boot when my due date came, but I was not using the crutches anymore. I could like walk around on the air boot. So, you know, a week later when my water finally broke, I think I took the air boot with me to the birth center, but I didn't wear it while I was in labor because I was like, okay, like I'm done with this.
Right.
I'm not wearing this during labor.
You got other things to worry about.
Yeah. Yeah.
So your water broke about 2 weeks after your due date.
No, 1 week after my due date. Yeah.
So your water broke 1 week after your due date. And your husband was home by then.
He was home. Yeah. He came home about a week before my due date. And we were just like preparing all the last minute things and everything. I had a stretch and sweep on like the Saturday. And then on Monday evening, my water broke. But it was weird because, like, you know, you always picture when you haven't been through it before, you picture your water breaking and there being like this big rush of liquid that like splashes on the floor and everything. But for me, it didn't happen that way at all. I was vacuuming and like I felt a little gush, like kind of in my underwear, but not so much that I kind of questioned. I was like, when you're past due and you've already lost your mucus plug, like you have discharge, right? So I was like, was that my water break? I'm not sure. And when I texted my midwife and I'm like, I don't know, like maybe my water broke, maybe I'm jumping the gun. And she was like, okay, well, if you're not sure, then like probably not, but just in case, like sleep on it and then come see me first thing in the morning. So first thing in the morning, I went to see her and they did, you know, they can kind of like test the fluid to see if it is amniotic fluid. And sure enough, she's like, oh yeah, your water did break. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then, so did anything change from then, like in terms of care, in terms of what you were thinking, what the midwife was thinking?
Yeah. So, because I was group B strep negative, they weren't super concerned that, that my water had broken. With the midwives, they'll give it, up to 96 hours after your water has broken, at least in Quebec where I live, 96 hours before they'll kind of transfer you to an OB for basically a C-section, right? So they said, okay, well, you know, we've got time. However, we'd prefer if you have this baby sooner than later. So they start to do some kind of gentle encouraging, right? So water broke on Monday night. On Tuesday, I went in there. They checked. They said, yes, your water broke. And then she said, okay, well, if you don't mind, I want to keep you here today to try to encourage the baby to come. And so what they did was they used a breast pump. And I did like 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off of the breast pump to try to get the contractions going. And she was giving me like some homeopathic tinctures and like red raspberry leaf tea and stuff like that. My naturopath came to the birth center and did some acupuncture in between using the breast pump. I got contractions while the breast pump was going, but then they would kind of like peter out. They weren't like super consistent. So we did that from like 8 a.m. until 4 p.m. And then my midwife was like, okay, this is not going to happen today. Go home, get some rest. If you reach, you know, if the contractions come at any point and you reach that kind of, what is it, like the 411, you know, like.
Right. Contractions happening every 4 minutes happening and being a minute or longer.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Lasting for an hour. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So she said, if you reach that milestone, call me. So basically, as soon as I went to bed that night, I started feeling the contractions pick up a little bit. And, you know, I kind of felt like things were happening because I couldn't really sleep. By midnight, I woke my husband up and I'm like, I think I'm 411. So we called the midwife and she said, okay, you know, why don't you, you know, meet me at the birth center in an hour or whatever. So we headed to the birth center at that point. And that was Wednesday morning at, by the time we got there, I think it was like 4:30 or 5 in the morning, because it like, you know, it took us a while to like get things ready, call the midwife, like get a line. I don't, the timeline seems kind of like a blur, but for some reason I feel like it was more like 4:30 or 5 when we actually got there. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And at that point, contractions, you were feeling like they were taking your full attention and you couldn't quite do anything else while they were happening?
Yeah, like I was using my hypnobirthing technique to like breathe through them. They were manageable, but I definitely would like stop and like focus on my breathing when they came.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. So you get to the birth center. What happens then? Like, were they going to check you, or were they trying to avoid that because your waters had been broken, released for several days?
She did check me. And so this is another one of these big learnings I had. was, and something that I'm really glad I did, was in my birth plan, I had written that I didn't, if they were going to check me, I didn't want them to tell me how dilated I was. And I actually got that tip from your show. I forget what episode it was, but one of the birth stories, the mama had said that she did that. And when I heard that, I knew that that was going to be a good technique for me, because I'm like, I will focus on that. If somebody gives me a number, I will focus on that and obsess over it. So I had told them, like, you can check me all you want. Don't tell me how dilated I am. You can tell my doula. You can tell my husband. Don't tell me. Mm-hmm. So no, they checked me when I got there. But
yeah, I love that. So because it can be, if you know specifically that that's going to get in your head, and that birth is not linear, it does its own thing. So that number really doesn't mean that much. But if we put so much stock into it, yeah. So don't tell me they didn't tell you, but do you know how long, how far apart you were now?
Yeah. So after the fact, of course, they told me, when I got to the birth center, I was only like 2 centimeters. And because my water had broken and it had been a little while, my midwife made the call to keep me at the birth center. I found out after the fact, like, I guess if I had been at a hospital, or if I had been like at a birth center in a different province of Canada, they're actually like, they have a rule that like they have to send you home if you're not 4 centimeters. So I guess I was lucky that I was where I was at a birth center in Quebec, where the midwives have more discretion, where they don't necessarily have to send you home if you're not 4 centimeters.
And it's always so interesting to me, the different practices around the world in terms of birth, and even not around the world, like even across the hospitals and birth centers and just in your own town. Because here, if your water is broken and you go to the hospital, in my neck of the woods, it's like, okay, your water's broken. You're going to have a baby at some point. Let's keep you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the midwife told me afterward that the fact that my water had broken did definitely weigh in her decision. But she told me, if you had been at the hospital, then it would have been either like, okay, we're either going to give you a C-section because nothing's happening, or induce you, or like, if the timing is right, we're going to send you home. There would have been no scenario in which it was like, we're not going to induce you. We're not going to give a C-section, but we are going to keep you here, even though you're 2 centimeters, you know?
Yeah. And then here it would be that push of, it's been this long and you're going, but not, you need help. So let's induce you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So, but I, like, Adriana, I thought I was like full blown in labor, because the contractions were getting more and more intense. And by like noon, which was around the next time she checked me, like, they were intense enough that I had some tears, like my hypnobirthing techniques were getting me through, but like I was convinced that this was happening quickly. But I found out after the fact that when she checked me at noon, only then was I 4 centimeters. And then when she checked me again at like 4 PM when there was a shift change, so the like backup midwife came in, I was only 5 centimeters. So it was actually going quite slowly, and I had no idea, because I like the contractions were getting steadily more intense. And
where were you feeling them?
You know, where was I feeling them?
Yeah.
I mean, like, I guess in my like lower abdomen. He was sitting really low. For the past few weeks, he had been sitting really low, which actually is something else I wanted to mention, because you said that the midwives measure your belly. My belly measurements had plateaued in the last few weeks. And everyone kept saying, oh, you look so small. I can't believe you're 9 months pregnant. Your belly's so small. But it was because he had moved very low. And so, you know, he was like deep down in there. So my belly wasn't protruding that much. And I ended up having just about a 9-pound baby. So another learning is, just because your belly is measuring small doesn't mean your baby is small.
Right? Yeah. Or vice versa. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I felt it, you know, kind of. I didn't have back labor, if that's what you're asking. I did not have back labor.
Yeah. And I was wondering if it was, because sometimes it can take longer because baby's not in the greatest position. So I was wondering about that.
He was perfect. He was head down, like facing sideways. I forget which side is optimal, but they told me he was in like the optimal position.
Yeah, the LOA left side.
Yeah.
Cool.
So yeah, I don't know. I'd say it was just slow to dilate.
Just how it was going to go. So
yeah.
You said, you know, you were staying focused, you were doing your best. It went from 4:30 in the morning to then noon to then 4 p.m. shift change. You got checked. You were five, but didn't know it. Yeah. Where were you at this point in terms of thinking, I've got this, this is getting to be too much? Like, where was your mind?
It was hard, but at that point in time, I still thought I can do this, but I also thought I was near the end, right? So I think that's why I thought I could do it, because I was convinced that, okay, like, this is really intense. I must be getting close, right? I had already, you know, like, I think, I'm sure it's so hard to remember the timelines, but at some point in the evening, a little bit of blood started to come out, which at first I was really scared, but then the midwife and the doula were like, no, that's good. That's a good sign.
I'm sure at that point they were like sigh of relief of like, yes, we've got blood now.
Yeah, exactly. There was like cheering.
Yeah.
So I really thought I was near the end, like basically the whole time. But I wasn't, my doula was so, so helpful. She was like doing acupressure and like letting me lean on her and like suggesting different positions and like feeding me watermelon and making me drink water. And like it was really, really useful to have her there. And even just so she could give Felix, my husband, tips on what he could be doing to help as well. And so then toward in the evening, that's when I started like the hypnobirthing at that point kind of left my brain. I know that like for some women, they're able to stay in that zone the whole time, like through to the end. For me, like when it got really intense, I could not stay in that super zen state of mind. And the only thing that helped was I started to get really vocal, and they, you know, my naturopath and my midwife encouraged me to like use that. And this was on one of your episodes as well. I remember it's like, use that guttural kind of like low, like moan/yell to like help the baby down. And that yelling, I feel bad for everyone in the birth center, but that yelling was the only thing that got me through. And it got like, by the end, I was very, very loud. But, you know, to the point where my husband put in earplugs. He was letting me like lean on him and I was screaming right in his ear. And so I do not blame him, but he had earplugs on.
I feel that so deeply because I was the same. And it was just that was my coping mechanism. That was getting me through it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Oh. So and at one point, basically – they had, so my doula and my husband and my midwife had a little huddle in the hallway without me knowing. And the midwife basically said, look, things are not progressing. She's only 5 centimeters. I could send her home, but I feel like she's so exhausted that will really deflate her and like it's not going to be good. So the suggestion was to try to be more proactive in making things speed up. So what they did at that point was they brought out the breast pump again and they had me do, I can't remember if it was 5 minute or 10 minute increments, but basically like the on off again. And in between breast pumping, which by the way, the breast pump made the contraction so much more intense. Mm-hmm. And in between, you know, the only position I wanted to be in was on all fours, like kind of in like a ball. And because that was the position that made the contractions the most manageable. But what they said to me was like, at this point, you're not going for manageable, because that means that like you're keeping the baby from moving down. You want to go in those positions that are actually the most uncomfortable, because those are the ones that mean it's putting pressure on the baby, it's moving him down. So for me, that was like squatting, sitting on the toilet, and the birthing stool. Or like, oh, and also they had me do this, like they called it the runner's pose. So it was like kind of a like a lunge, like you're on one knee, kind of like lunging.
Yeah, is it like getting down on one knee to propose?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So they had me rotate between like all of the positions I hated the most. and man, that was intense. And we did that for like an hour and a half. Oh, and they were giving me like tinctures and stuff. We did that for an hour and a half, and then they checked me again. And again, there was like cheering, because at this point in time, after all that, I said to the midwife, and this was like, by this time it was like 9 or 10 at night. I said to the midwife, okay, I know, like I didn't want to know, but now I really need to know where we're at.
Yeah, because I've been thinking forever, I'm done, and it's not happening.
It's not done. Yeah. And like that was during that time, that was when I was really like, that was the point in time where I was like, I don't know if I can do this. And I said to Felix, like, Felix, I don't know if I can do this. And he said to me, Shay, this is what you wanted. You can do this. You are doing this. And like, I am here to help make sure that you don't have to go to the hospital. That's what you wanted. You didn't want to go to the hospital. This is what we're doing. And he kind of like gave me this pep talk, which I told him beforehand. I said, when I get to that point where I want to give up, don't let me. So he didn't. And that was really helpful too. So then when we got checked after an hour and a half of that, when I was like really hitting a wall, I said, okay, tell me where we're at. And when she said you're at 8 centimeters, at first I wanted to cry, because I was like, how can I not be at 10? But then she was like, no, this is great.
Let's tell you what happened all day long.
Exactly. Yeah. So she was like, you don't understand. An hour and a half ago, you were 5 and now you're 8. So yeah,
whatever was keeping like just that nudge, like this is something that I so see over and over in birth, whenever things get quote unquote stuck or are not going so much, this need for proactivity, because some things, like you're doing what you're doing and that's not working, something needs to change. And that doesn't necessarily mean like full on blown out medical interventions, but getting to a mental state of like, okay, I've got to do whatever needs to be done because this is just exhausting me.
Yeah.
And the thing is, when you do the things, you try different things, and most often than not, there's no guarantees, but you know, 95% of the time you hit on that thing that was needed.
Yeah.
And then things take off. Like the change is immediate, which is so gratifying that you get that instant feedback of, yeah, there it was. We did it. Like we turned the corner. Here we go.
Yeah, exactly. And it was like that. And then, you know, the last 2 centimeters, I feel like that time flew by. Now, we weren't doing the breast pump anymore. I was still doing the terrible poses that I really hated. But that time felt like it flew by. And before I knew it, like I was pushing. So, and then, you know, actually that's when it got interesting again, because they're now monitoring the heart rate, with that little kind of Doppler machine, between every contraction. And at one point, I think I was on the birthing stool. At one point they said, okay, the heart rate is dropping. The policy at the birth center is to call the ambulance, which is only 5 minutes. Like the hospital is literally around the corner. So, they called the ambulance, but they said, look, just cause we call it doesn't mean you need to get in it. Let's try some other positions, and see if that helps. So, you know, after all the like research that I did and the videos that I watched and the books that I read, I never thought I would give birth on my back with my legs in the air, but that's how I gave birth, because that was the only position where the heart rate was strong. So yeah, I didn't end up getting in the ambulance, but it was called. And the midwife said to me at that point, you know, again, like I go back to my hypnobirthing class where they're like, you breathe the baby out. You don't really need to push. You can just like breathe it out. And then you'll prevent tearing and all these things. But when it came down to it, because of the heart rate issue, my midwife was like, if you don't want to get in the ambulance, you need to get this baby out quickly.
Was that Felix laughing in the background?
Yes. Yes.
I love it.
He's laughing because he was at the hypnobirthing class and we both thought that it was going to be so easy based on, you know, watching those hypnobirthing videos and like these women literally breathing out their baby. And that was not how it was for me at all.
Right.
I pushed as hard as I've ever pushed. And 45 minutes later, the baby came out, cord very tightly wrapped around his neck, which was the problem with the heart rate. But you know, they unwrapped him and he was fine. One thing I wanted to note, cause it was super helpful, was when I was pushing, at first I didn't really know like where to push, right? My midwife put her finger on his head basically, or like near his head. And she said, focus your pushing there. And I like kind of pushed like on her hand basically. And that really helped me understand how to push him out.
Mm-hmm. And I find that, so many things come up when you say all that. You know, hypnobirthing can be a great tool. Those are fabulous tools, but oh, yeah. You've got to have a lot of tools in your bag because that,
yes.
In your case, it carried you only so far and then you had other things. And that being loud, having to push, having to do things a little differently and more actively doesn't mean that, you know, you're not getting what you want or that you were in any way a failure or right. It's just birth is a primal thing that comes in different ways. And when people say, oh, I was so loud, the image that comes to my mind is that of a thunderstorm.
Yeah.
Like it's powerful. It's natural. It's nature. It's, you know, there's so much intensity and it's loud, but there's nothing wrong, right?
Right, yeah. And don't get me wrong. Like, if I had to go back and do it all over again, I would do the hypnobirthing class again. Mm-hmm. What I will say is it was really helpful for me the few weeks beforehand and in the beginning phases because I wasn't scared at any point. Like, even when I was exhausted, I wasn't scared. And I think that the hypnobirthing course is what gave me that. And that was incredibly helpful.
Mm-hmm. That's huge. That's huge. Yeah. No, I do. Yeah. I just sometimes I hear from people, I did the hypnobirthing course and then it wasn't like that. And they feel like it should have been that way. And I think it's more about not having an expectation of a should specific way that birth should look like. Because it can be that quiet and calm, but it can also be, you know, this raging storm. And they're all just as good and valid.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you said he was 9 pounds.
Just about, yeah, he was 8 pounds and 15 ounces.
So, and you're not a very big person, so there was a lot, it required a little bit more force and a little bit more directed pushing and the whole thing of pushing, that is a technique that can be really helpful of having fingers in when to focus that energy. And sometimes we talk about like push her fingers out.
Yeah.
Focus on pushing her fingers out. And that tends to be really, I've seen it work well.
Yeah, it was really helpful. Because when I first started like feeling pushy, it wasn't like, you know, they talk about this feeling of like, you feel like you have to poop. It didn't really feel like that for me. Like I just felt like he was getting really heavy and maybe it was like, maybe I started pushing too soon because I was just really anxious to be done. Mm. But like, it just didn't feel as kind of like just easy and natural as I thought it would until he was like really kind of, the head was almost out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then there was also the extra layer of, I'm sure, everybody around going, heartbeat is dipping. Like, and that whole, just that layer of heartbeat dipping and having you get in a position not that was working for you to push, but a position that he could tolerate.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, I mean... on the back, legs in the air, just like you see in the movies.
Hold your breath and curl up.
Exactly.
I mean, that's what was needed at that point.
Yeah, exactly. And then when he came out, well, first of all, I will say that his skin was like almost black. It was so blue because of the cord being wrapped around. But as soon as they like flipped him around and unwrapped it, he pinked right up. And, I didn't even really notice that he looked so dark when he came out, but it scared Felix a bit. He talks about it now, like, oh my God, like I was like, is he okay? But then as soon as they put him on my chest, he pinked right up and he was great. So one thing I did not realize, was that with the delayed cord clamping, cause I, you know, we had talked about with my midwife, how I wanted that was their standard anyways. I guess after I pushed the baby out, I was so anxious to be done that I was like, can I please push out the placenta now? she's like, sure, if you want to. So I pushed the placenta out and then they were like, okay, now we cut the cord since the placenta is out. And I was like, wait, what? Because I didn't realize, I mean, it makes sense now that you think about it, but I didn't realize that once the placenta is out, you might as well cut the cord. And if I had known that, I probably wouldn't have been as anxious to push the placenta out right away because I would have wanted the cord to, like, I would have wanted to wait a little bit longer.
And, you know, physiologically, like, you were encouraging that placenta to come down, but you can't, unless you're getting in there manually and grabbing it and pulling, you know, if the placenta's not ready, it's not going to release. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, like, it seemed like I had envisioned that it was going to be a noticeable wait before we cut the cord. And it seemed like it happened right away. But then in hindsight, when I was talking to my midwife about it, she's like, no, I mean, it was a good like five to seven minutes, which apparently, like, it felt like it was like immediate. But she said, that's a decent amount of time. Don't worry. He got the benefit of that cord.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, so. Did you tear?
I had the tiniest little tear on the inside wall. I didn't have any tears on my perineum. And we didn't do stitches because the midwife was like, this is such a tiny tear. It's going to be healed in a day or two. Just leave it.
Yeah, and just in the inside wall, trying to get the stitch over there would be so uncomfortable. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, I had used a device called an Epino, which is, it's kind of controversial in the sense that, like, a lot of places that I've read or people I've heard talking about it have said, like, it doesn't, you know, you might as well just do the perineal massage. The Epino doesn't really help. And other people I talked to, like moms that I talked to who used it, were like, I swear this was like the holy grail. Like, it saved my perineum. So, I just thought like it couldn't hurt. And especially since I found it really hard to do the perineal massage myself and my husband was away. So, I just couldn't really reach very well. So the Epino, is a device that helps you prepare your perineum, without having to get in that weird position. And I really believe that that is what prepared my perineum and the reason why I didn't tear. You know, 9-pound baby, I didn't tear. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And I think it's one of those things that whether you need to do anything or not do, it's hard to say, but that's only a decision you can make.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things that seems helpful about the Epino is that you get biofeedback, right? You can see a gauge. You can see there's that specific response. So that your mind's involved in figuring this out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I knew what to expect because it really... it really shows you what it feels like to have a 10 centimeter round thing there, right? Like a baby head. And so again, I think it contributed to me not being afraid, which was really helpful.
Mm-hmm. And we'll link it on the show notes. You sent me the link. And it's basically like, well, you can explain it. It's like a balloon that you're inflating slowly.
Yep. A balloon with like a little hand pump with like a gauge so you can see what the pressure is. And you do it like I did it every day starting at, when did I start? I think 34 weeks was when I started. And I did it every day for 10 minutes. And look, it's not fun. It's not comfortable, but it's also not really painful. And you do it slowly. You don't do 10 centimeters on the first day. But eventually I got there and it really helped. They don't sell them in Canada. I don't know if they sell them in the States.
They don't. I looked at the website. So it's we'll link it, but you might not even be able to get one.
I know they used to sell them in Canada because I have friends who have used them, but there was some weird law about importing medical devices that made it so that they couldn't sell them in Canada anymore. And so I had – my mother-in-law lives in Europe. I had her buy one and mail it to me. And, I would use it again for sure. But like you said, I don't know whether you need to or not. I don't know. It might have been all in my head that it helped me. But I would do it again.
Mm. So as we wrap up, was there something specifically that you wanted to make sure people heard that we haven't gotten?
I think like the biggest thing is like arm yourself with lots of information, but also don't expect things to go the way you expect them to go. Right. And I know I've said it a couple times already, but for me, the most useful thing was just like, to not be afraid. And you know, to all those moms who like, you know, someone told me, oh, your baby's really big, you're really small, you know, this is going really slowly, like just all of these negative things that people can tell you, take them in stride and don't be afraid, you know, be proactive, but don't be afraid.
Yeah. And listen to the good, to the balance them out.
yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, in the end, what I will say, like, if there's anyone who will listen to this who is considering having an unmedicated birth, the way I felt afterward was, okay, that was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. But I would do it again in a heartbeat because I feel superhuman. Having been able to do that, I felt like I could do anything, like totally on top of the world. And when I think back on it, I still feel that way. And I think we were driving home from the birth center the next morning, and my husband said to me that he felt like it was like I was a Marine, like in the Marine Corps, where they like they push you to your limits physically and emotionally, and then you come out of it like superhuman strength because you were able to go through that. And it made me feel really good that he compared me to a Marine. It was just like totally on top of the world feeling.
Yeah. And it, like, what a delight to go into parenting feeling I've got anything that you throw my way. I got it all. I did this. I can take anything.
Yeah, exactly. And like, yeah, I mean, I kept saying to myself when it was getting really tough, the mantra from hypnobirthing, actually. So I guess that's another thing I got from the course that I kept saying in my head was, this is really hard, but I can do hard things. And I still say that to myself sometimes when I feel like things are hard, like I can do hard things.
Mm-hmm. I love that saying. Yeah. Shay, thank you so very much for sharing your story. This was really great.
No problem.
Great.
Thank you for letting me share my story.
Mighty ones, find the in-depth show notes for this episode at birthful.com, where you can also learn more about me, the show, send me messages, and more. This episode was produced by me and made possible by you. The title song for this podcast is Vive Ace by Kevin McLeod, and the sponsorship song is Air Hockey Saloon by Chris Zabriskie. Find them both at freemusicarchive.org. Oh, and here is what Shay had for breakfast.
Yes, I had muesli for breakfast today.
I'm Adriana Losada. Please join me next week when I'll be talking to another maternity pro to inform your intuition here at the Birthful Podcast. Thanks so very much for listening. This episode is copyright 2019 by Adriana Losada.
Hey, Mighty One. Did you know that if you started listening to one Birthful episode per day at the start of your pregnancy, your baby would be about 3 months old before you got through all of them? That is so much Birthful. So to ease us into the summer and to help you catch up on your listening, we're going back to releasing one episode per week instead of two. Now you know.